second case for oral argument this morning is the South Dakota Department of Revenue Appellant versus Lauren Poirier and others, appellees. For the state, we have Mr. John Gewin, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, and for the appellees, we have Ms. Vanya Hogan from St. Paul. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Richard Sabers, a former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Zinner's behalf. With that, Mr. Gewin, you have 20 minutes, and you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court. Your Honors, under SDCL 10-59-34, attorney's fees are available to a litigant if the litigant demonstrates the Department of Revenue's position in the case is not substantially justified, and I've set out the statute at the bottom of page 9 in our opening brief. The statute is a limited exception to the American law approach. Attorney's fees in American law are obviously generally paid by the litigant to win or lose. Court has twice interpreted this statute in Northern States and Farmer, both times narrowly, both times it has denied fees. Despite the narrow construction of the statute by this court, the lower court imposed attorney's fees under the statute, finding that the department's position in the Puya litigation was not substantially justified.
Who has the burden of proof?
Certainly the applicant for attorney's fees has the burden of proof, clearly, under this court's cases.
Okay.
So the department bought this appeal to maintain what it understands to be the correct interpretation of 10-59-34. Analysis of the substantial justification issue requires some reference to the underlying Puya litigation with which the members of this court are sure familiar. Money Creek Oil and Gas Incorporated filed a motor fuel tax refund request with the department. Money Creek was a state chartered corporation, asserted that it was an Indian in Indian country, and thus immune from the state gas tax, and claimed refund for all the gas it had sold over a number of years. Demanded a refund of $1 million for the taxes for the gas it had sold and damages of $140,000. The hearing examiner denied the request, but on appeal, Judge Center, who was then a circuit court judge, affirmed the denial of the request, and three trips to this court followed. When the dust cleared, there were four issues had been decided for the state, two for Puyer. Money Creek had demanded $1.2 million, had been awarded $18,000, about 2% of that. And a couple other things followed, though not ordered by this court. The state set up an arrangement such that gas stations should no longer collect the tax from Indians in Indian country. And the state set aside the $4.8 million for use by 8 tribes with gas stations in Indian country for the use of highways and the reservations. In the present case, Puyer argues that the department's position in the Muddy Creek litigation was not substantially justified under the statute 10-59-34, which brings us to the meaning of substantially justified. The two cases decided by this court, Northern States and Farmer, both set out a narrative as to the rule and then explain the operation of the rule. And the narrative both recites that the state's position has to be based in truth, with a reasonable legal basis, and facts and legal theory must be reasonably connected. And then Northern States goes on to cite California authority that a position is substantially justified when it is justified to a degree that would satisfy a reasonable person, when it has a reasonable basis in both law and fact, and then goes on to quote a Supreme Court case, Pierce v. Underwood, a position could be substantially, that is to say for the most part, justified if a reasonable person could think it correct, that is, if it has a reasonable basis in fact and law. And then makes a fourth description of what this statute means. It says, the position is substantially justified if it's a matter of first impression and it has some plausible basis in fact and law. So the four descriptions of what this test means, all are objective, all call for a reasonable man. Just last year in the Farmer case, this court again interpreted the statute. Again, it referred to the reasonable or not unreasonable standard. And it found that because the department had not ever before litigated the question before this court would find that the department position was substantially justified. So the court has entered into several explanations of what this rule means, and it has looked to whether a reasonable person would or could find that the argument had merit. And when it's a matter of first impression, as this case is, it looks to whether there's some plausible basis in fact and law.
Are you offering us a fifth definition then by saying they only recovered 2% of the money they sought? Is this a dollars and cents analysis now?
We're not fighting about whether or not Puyer won this litigation. He did get a recovery. His recovery was slight, though. His recovery was not very much, and I think that does go into the analysis of whether the state's overall position was justified. And we think that that is what this case is about: the state's overall position, the state's overall position in the litigation. Of course, even when the state entirely loses the case, such as in I think in the Farmer case, the state can still and frequently should still succeed.
Are you advocating a bright line rule then, because the department initially succeeded at the circuit court level prior to the first trip up here?
No. What we are saying, however, is that it is a very significant part of the puzzle. And we think in the context of this case, when you look in particular at Judge Zinter's opinion, we think that it is a very persuasive opinion. We think it's concise, it's comprehensive, it covers all the issues with regard to Hayden Cartwright. And we think with an opinion like that, it goes a very 95% of the way, we think, towards showing that the state's position does have a reasonable basis in fact and law.
So you're saying it's not a bright line rule, but it's darn close.
It's darn close. Yes, Your Honor. Especially, I think, with a very strong, comprehensive, lucid opinion, such as we saw from Judge Zinter. There were six issues that were decided. Four were decided in the state's favor. The incidence of tax on the consumer was on the consumer, not on Muddy Creek, as Muddy Creek claimed. The state statute of limitations issue was found in favor of the state. There's no class action for recovery of the tax and no procedural due process violation. That again, is a strong indication that the state's overall position was substantially justified and that it won four out of the six issues. In Farmer, when the state won one issue and lost two issues below, its position was substantially justified. So
where did Judge Brown err?
Judge Brown erred, we think, because he simply misconstrued the statute. He basically rewrote the substantially justified test. He actually erred in two ways. The first way Judge Brown erred was by not considering at all, not commenting at all on the state's argument that because Muddy Creek was a state chartered corporation, it was not a tribal member and therefore was not eligible for a refund, and whether or not that argument sitting by itself substantially justified the state's entire course of litigation. We think it did. There was well-reasoned precedent that supported the state. The recent Braga products case said was just right on point. An entity incorporated under state law could not be considered an enrolled member simply because its sole shareholder is a member of the tribe. Right on point. Said to us that issue should have won, and that whatever else happened in the case, that Puyer should have been zeroed out, or Muddy Creek should have been zeroed out in litigation simply because it was not an Indian country. Baraga cited Moline Products, which is a Supreme Court case. The taxpayer adopts the corporate form for its own purposes, and when he takes the advantages, he's got to take the disadvantages. Fit right into our case. Very strong logic to that case. Judge Brown didn't answer it. There was other authority supporting the state's position in that regard, the Village of Arlington Heights case. And there's also the further point. This is a tribal membership is discretionary with the tribe. The state cannot endow an entity with tribal membership. And when you look at least it's arguable. One way to look at what happened was that the state did, in fact, endow a state chartered corporation with tribal membership, which seems to us, at least there's a decent argument, that should only be done by the tribe itself. Anyway, so the first error, we think, of the circuit court is not even confronting this very important issue, this critical issue, which we think should have won the case for the state. The second major error of the circuit court was its misunderstanding, we think, of the substantially justified test. We think the circuit court applied the test in a markedly different way than this court had in Farmer and the Northern States. The circuit court found the department's position to be not substantially justified, mainly because it thought the department's position on the Hayden Cartwright issue had not been taken in truth, and that was what the circuit court's case was all about. That was a subjective test, apparently, to the circuit court. As Puyer explains in his brief, truth is sincerity in action, character, and utterance. And Puyer explains on page 15 of his brief, that the circuit court found the department was not sincere because the tax specialist did not know about Hayden Cartwright or its reporting requirement. That's on page 15 of its brief. But sincerity isn't a test. It's a reasonable man test. And the actual question is whether or not a reasonable observer would determine that the law and evidence could satisfy a reasonable person. And that brings into play all the factors. The text of Hayden Cartwright, the use of the word reservation, the use of the AG opinion as to Hayden Cartwright, the solicitor's opinion, the AG case, Judge Zinter's opinion, certainly a big part of it, Supreme Court cases interpreting the term reservation, and so on. But the circuit court didn't involve itself in that kind of analysis, rather focused on two subjective factors. Now, the first subjective factor it focused on, it seems to us that's inapposite anyway. The circuit court's argument, and Fourier's argument, is that Elena Gornell, who was a tax specialist within the department, didn't know about the Hayden Cartwright reporting requirement, or maybe even about the Hayden Cartwright Act itself. But the problem is that what Gornell knew or didn't know really isn't even relevant here. Gornell didn't impose the tax. The Department of Revenue imposed the tax. The circuit court couldn't find that the secretary or the governor or whatever was not sincere and didn't have the evidence to do so. It's really irrelevant when you look at what what Gornell thought. Is really irrelevant when you look at what the department's position was. 1978 in the AGE case, clearly we've taken the position that Hayden Cartwright allowed taxation of Indians in Indian country. In 1994, in the brief that Poirier complains about, we took the position before the United States Supreme Court. In 1996, in a letter to Poirier's lawyer, which is set out on page 83 of the brief that Poirier got put into the record at the last minute, we explained very carefully that our position was based on Hayden Cartwright. So the department's position had been clear, and the fact that there's one person within the Department of Revenue didn't know about the reporting requirement of Hayden Cartwright seems to us to just be irrelevant. What difference does it make? And indeed, when you look at Hayden Cartwright itself, there's another reason to say that it doesn't make any difference. Poirier seems to be relying on is Section B of the Hayden Cartwright Act. And that says that a federal officer in charge of a reservation has to submit to the taxing authority of the state some kind of a form showing the amount of motor fuel with respect to which taxes are payable. So that requirement is on a federal officer. It isn't on a state officer. It wasn't on Elena Gornell. It wasn't on anybody within the department. This was on the federal officer. In fact, there were no duties imposed upon any state officer. What difference does it make whether or not a state officer didn't know about something the federal officer wasn't doing that should have been doing? And that becomes really especially true when you look at what was happening at Ellsworth Air Force Base. Hayden Cartwright indisputably allows the state gas tax to be levied on military reservations like Ellsworth. The tax is levied there, but the federal officers never filed that report. Now, maybe Poirier would argue that collecting that tax is not in truth, but that wouldn't make any sense. This whole matter of Hayden Cartwright reporting requirement and Elena Gornell seems to us very much to be a distraction. And not a real issue, even though that's what the circuit court relied on. The circuit court did have a second ground for finding the state's action was not in truth under Hayden Cartwright, and that is that the South Dakota enacted its tax in 1923, 13 years prior to Hayden Cartwright, and therefore the state, I guess, had to be in bad faith by collecting the tax. But again, this is not a very substantial argument either. Take the case of our Minnesota neighbors. Prior to the enactment of Public Law 280, Minnesota enacted a criminal code applicable facially all over the state, but not actually on reservations, even though statutes don't say so. It's only after Public Law 280 went into effect was Minnesota criminal code applicable to Indians on the reservation. But Minnesota wasn't in bad faith before that date. It was not in truth before that date. This statute simply wasn't applicable there. And that's irrelevant for other reasons, too.
All right. Well, Mr. Kuhn, on that. If I remember right, was there evidence or there was not evidence that the tax was collected on the reservation prior to the enactment of the statute?
Poirier's had 10 or 15 years now to come up with evidence that any tax at all was collected between 1923 and 1936 on the reservation. There's nothing in the record that says a single penny was collected during that period. And I think that is significant. But let's take it one step further. Let's say that the tax had been collected, hypothetically. It wasn't. There's no evidence. But it still wouldn't make any difference because laws are passed with some frequency, legitimizing activity which is ongoing, and it just doesn't make any sense to say, well, you collected a tax wrongfully in 1930, therefore the tax you're collecting in 1970 is wrongful or 1980 is wrongful. It just doesn't make any sense. Time passes, laws get passed, legitimate activity, and that's fine. That's the way it is. There's another problem with this subjective standard that I'd like to bring to the attention of the court, and that is from the Department of Revenue perspective and from the taxpayer perspective, too. The Department does a couple thousand audits per year. Occasionally, the Department is going to make an error, absolutely certain. And so the question is the purpose to unleash the plaintiff's attorneys on the Department of Revenue to find some employee who doesn't know all the facts about a particular act, maybe was disgruntled, or maybe had been overruled by legal counsel? It seems to us that that would be the wrong emphasis if attorney's fees are asked in a future case. The emphasis should be on whether or not the Department position, in fact, did have a reasonable basis, in fact, in law. What would a reasonable person think? That's the real test. That's what's really important to the state. The subjective analysis simply isn't important, in our view. Under the proper analysis, under Hayden Cartwright, we think the state should succeed. There are two tests that can be drawn from Northern States and Farmer. Both are what a reasonable person could or would think is correct. And the second, it's a matter of first impression, as this court identified it in Puyer 1, whether or not the state's position has some plausible basis in fact and law. Both tests are objective, and under either test, we think the state's position is substantially justified. The first reason, I've already had a chance to talk a little bit about that, and that's Judge Zinter's decision. It's a careful, comprehensive decision, I think, takes the state a very long way to the position that it was substantially justified. Secondly, when you look at the text of Hayden Cartwright, it says that the states can tax, can levy gas taxes on sales by filling stations or licensed traders on U.S. and military and other reservations. There are two terms there which we think unmistakably indicate that a gas tax on tribal members is allowable, or at the very least, indicate the state was substantially justified to so argue. The first is reservation. If we pick a lawyer at random from those who are going to be appearing before you today, tomorrow, and yesterday, and says, I'm going to talk about reservations. Well, they're not going to be. What comes to mind immediately is not the national forest, not a mineral reserve, or not a bird sanctuary, as Puyer suggests on page 24 of his brief. It's an Indian reservation. And we think the same is true in 1936 when Hayden Cartwright was enacted. And why do I say that? In 1909, the Supreme Court had found the term reservation included an Indian reservation. In 1934, just 2 years before Hayden Cartwright, the Congress had gone through the arduous process of adopting the Indian Reorganization Act. Indians very much on the mind, reservation very much on the mind. General purpose dictionaries, legal dictionaries from that period, both included Indian reservations as reservations. And just 2 years after Hayden Cartwright, the Attorney General of the United States twice indicated in an official opinion the term reservation should be broadly construed and included an Indian reservation, and even included national parks as reservations, even though they would normally not be thought to be reservations. Puyer comes here 60, 70 years later and says, don't interpret things the way the Attorney General did 2 years after Hayden Cartwright was enacted. No, interpret Hayden Cartwright very narrowly. That's not the way the Attorney General did in 1936, and that's not the better statutory construction. It's to look to see how those responsible for enforcing the act at the time it was passed would interpret it. Another way to look at how Hayden Cartwright should be interpreted is look at the AGE case. The AGE case cites two Eighth Circuit cases, 1942 and 1946, and they both urge a broad construction of Hayden Cartwright. And the second term used in Hayden Cartwright is licensed trader. That term also means that gas sales to Indians were to be taxed. Licensed traders were those licensed to sell goods to Indians within Indian country. If we look at both the United States Code and the Code of Federal Regulations, it's very clear from that licensed traders mean people trading with Indians and Indian reservations. It was a very clear message from the statute that this statute would apply to Indians on Indian reservations, or at least that the state was substantially justified in so arguing. Your Honor, as I can see, my time is just about up. So, if there are no more questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Ms. Horgan, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. In what my clients and I sincerely hope is our last trip to this court on this case, we're here so that you can decide whether the circuit court abused its discretion in awarding attorney's fees to Poirier under South Dakota Codified Laws 1059-34. And I put the language of the statute up here so we don't have to flip through appendices, etc., to look directly at it and focus on it. As you can see, the statute requires a losing party to pay the winner's fees if the losing party has taken a position that is not substantially justified. The circuit court found, and the department did not appeal, that the department was the losing party in this case. So it's too late now to start tallying up the wins and losses below for the department to start saying, to shoehorn the whether they were the losing party argument into the substantial justification test. That's not an issue here. The circuit court found that the department was a losing party, and the department didn't appeal that. So it doesn't matter whether Poirier recovered 2% of what he originally asked for or if he recovered 100%. He was the prevailing party. And indeed, as the department concedes, it's lost $8 to $12 million a year in revenues from taxes from Indians and Indian country as a result of this case. So I think it's pretty clear that Poirier was the winning party and the state was the losing party. What we're here to talk about is the only issue that the department actually appealed, which is Judge Brown's conclusion that the department took a position in the case that was not substantially justified. I want to make four main points in my argument. First, focus on what the standard of review here is. Secondly, talk about the language of the statute and what's not at issue. Third, go through the test that this court has twice said applies to determine whether a losing party's position is substantially justified. And then finally, walk through Judge Brown's application of that test so we can see whether he abused his discretion.
Before you do that, would you give us your opinion as to what mathematically, say on a scale of 0 to 10, what does substantially justified, where does that come in?
Well, I don't think that it is a mathematical calculation, and I don't think that courts have applied a mathematical calculation. What this court has said is there's a three-factor test to determine whether a position is substantially justified.
But it wouldn't be over 50%, would it? It'd be something less than 50%.
To be substantially justified?
Yes.
I suppose that it could be in a particular case.
Like preponderance of the evidence, everybody usually considered it was 51%. So in that context, what does substantially justified mean?
I guess in terms of trying to put a mathematical number on it, I'm not sure that you can. I think that the factors that this court has said to look at are, was the position based in truth? Was it a reasonable legal theory? And then did the facts and the legal theory come together?
Okay, go back to your argument.
Okay. Well, the first point I wanted to just touch on is the standard of review in this case. And as we pointed out in our brief, the department didn't raise the standard of review in its opening brief, and that's usually a good sign that it's not a good standard of review for the appellant. And indeed, here, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. That's what this court said both in the Northern States Power case, where it, I think, first addressed this statute, and in 2010 in the Farmer case. And what that means, this court has said, is that the court should only overturn the circuit court if it finds that the trial court has exercised its discretion, quote, to an end or purpose not justified by and clearly against evidence and reason. That's from the State versus Onken case that we cited in our brief. So only if this court finds that Judge Brown's findings and conclusions were an abuse of his discretion or clearly against evidence and reason should this court or can this court reverse his findings.
How did Judge Brown address the issue that initially the department had prevailed at the circuit court level?
How did he?
Yeah, what did he make of it? How did he analyze that? Because today the department's relying very heavily on it.
Well, what he said, relying on cases that we had cited from around the country from similar attorney fee statutes, is that the fact that you may convince some judge or hearing examiner or lower court that you have a winning position and you get reversed on appeal, it doesn't matter that you at one time convinced one judge or more. That is not proof that your position was substantially justified.
Well, in this case, say your client had never appealed. You lost in front of the initial circuit court. Not only would his opinion be substantially justified, the tax would still be being collected.
Right, and he would not have been applying for attorney's fees. Instead, we got a unanimous decision of this court that the Hayden-Cartwright Act did not authorize the tax. We also have now every single other court that has looked at this question has said the Hayden-Cartwright Act doesn't authorize this test. So, with respect, Judge Zinter got it wrong.
But this was a question. It wasn't decided prior to this issue wasn't decided prior to it going in front of Judge Zinter or this court initially. That was a case of first impression, was it not?
Well, I believe that certainly by the time it was argued to, or by the time this court issued its decision, I believe that there were three cases that had decided the issue. And I believe the Goodman Oil case out of the Supreme Court of Idaho had been decided by the time that Judge Zinter ruled. Before getting further into the test on substantial justification, I want to look at the language of the statute, because one of the arguments that Mr. Hewin is making is, well, Judge Brown didn't consider our argument that Muddy Creek was not really an Indian, it was a non-Indian corporation, and therefore this law was inapplicable, and that position was substantially justified. First of all, I don't think that position was substantially justified. They found the one district court case in the country that found that way. There was the weight of authority was the other way. But the test isn't, did the losing party take some position in the litigation that was substantially justified? It is, did they take a position that was not substantially justified? And what Judge Brown found was that their position on the Hayden-Cartwright Act issue was not substantially
justified. So your position is that a position, you're singling that out and saying that's singular. Any proposition that they took, if it wasn't substantially justified, would authorize attorney fees, not the overall position?
Well, that's what the language of the statute said.
Well, it is the way you've broken it out with red, but that isn't necessarily.
Well, I mean, we didn't change the text of it. All we did was turn two words to a different color. I don't think you have to reach the question of whether some tiny position that was not substantially justified in a case could mean that the whole case wasn't substantially justified, because here it was the main issue in the case was the Hayden-Cartwright Act issue, and Judge Brown found, and we believe correctly, that the department's position on that key issue was not substantially
justified.
So
that's the position that you're talking about?
Yes. Our position and what Judge Brown found is the department's Hayden-Cartwright Act argument that it authorized the tax was not substantially justified. This court has applied a three-factor test for determining when the losing party's position is substantially justified. First identified that test in the 1998 Northern States Power case, and then reaffirmed it in the Farmer case in 2010. The three factors are, was the position of the losing party based in truth? Did the theory propounded have a reasonable legal basis? And, you have to meet all three, were the facts alleged and the legal theory advanced reasonably connected?
Are those objective tests or subjective?
I think those are objective tests. Whether the position was based in truth, you can look at what is the truth and determine whether it was based in truth.
Did Judge Brown apply those objectively, or did he apply them subjectively?
I believe that he did apply them objectively. What's also important here is that when we argued this case to the circuit court, it was an entirely different case that the department was litigating then than Mr. Guin has been litigating in these briefs and in his argument today. If you look at the department's objections to our application for attorney fees, they specifically and only cited to the three-factor test that Judge Brown applied. In their objection to our attorney fee application at page 4, which is page 314 of our appendix, this is what they said was the test. For a position to be substantially justified, it must be based in truth. The legal theory propounded must have a reasonable legal basis, and the facts alleged and the legal theory advanced must be reasonably connected. That's a quote from their objections. They had that exact same quote in their brief in support of the objections, and that's the test that we all argued to Judge Brown. Now, on appeal, the department says, well, you don't really have to use those three factors. You can just use a reasonable man test. Well, that's a new argument, and you don't get to make new arguments on appeal in this court. In their reply brief, the department says, well, we did sort of raise that issue to Judge Brown in our objections to the proposed findings and conclusions. But by the time they did that, we had already briefed the entire case, and in fact, Judge Brown ordered supplemental briefing because the Farmer case had just come out, and he wanted to make sure that nobody's position changed in light of that. Department still stuck to the three-factor test as what they thought was the test. At the hearing in front of Judge Brown, that's what they argued. Then Judge Brown had already issued a memorandum opinion saying, I agree with Poirier, I'm granting the application for fees and costs. Poirier, you filed proposed findings and conclusions. It was only in response to that that the department in one line starts to say, oh, it's a reasonable man test, it's not this three-factor test. That's too late. There was no opportunity for us to respond, and Judge Brown had already issued his decision. If they were going to argue for that test, they should have done it before Judge Brown issued his decision. The law then, with respect to whether a position was substantially justified, is it's substantially justified if it meets this three-factor test. And Judge Brown found that their Hayden Cartwright Act argument, the big issue in the case, didn't meet this test. First, he found that the department's position was not based in truth. The department's position was that it began imposing this tax in Indian Country because Congress authorized it to. But the department began imposing this tax, or the state imposed this tax, statewide 13 years before Congress passed the Hayden Cartwright Act. Now, Mr. Guin says, you know, in the 15 years that this case has been going on, Poirier has never proved that there were taxes imposed back to 1923. Well, that's because the department never disputed this. We got the notion that the department had been imposing this tax back to 1923.
Well, is there any facts that show that the tax was collected prior to the enactment of Hayden?
There isn't evidence on that point. What we do have is when the department petitioned for rehearing in this case after the Poirier 1 decision, arguing that the court needed to impose a short statute of limitations, the department said, and we put their petition for rehearing in our appendix, you got to do this in part because if you don't, Indians are going to get refunds all the way back to 1923, and that will bankrupt the state. Well, how could they have gotten refunds back to 1923 if the state hadn't been imposing the tax?
But there is no evidence of that.
There is no evidence of it. Notably, and Judge Brown specifically found this in his opinion, the department didn't contest these arguments below. They didn't make the arguments that Mr. Guin is making here today about we didn't actually impose the tax in 1923, or it doesn't matter that the tax specialist didn't know about the act.
But are you claiming that the tax as enacted should have had a specific exclusion for not applying on the reservations? I've never seen a statute that applies statewide that sets out exceptions for reservations.
Well, what we're saying is the test says, was the department's position based in truth? And the department said, we're only imposing this because Congress authorized us to. Well, since they told us if you don't impose a statute of limitations that's 15 months, people can go all the way back to 1923, that doesn't seem like they actually were just imposing this tax because they thought Congress had authorized it. In addition, the expert that they brought in to testify at the administrative hearing about motor fuel taxes basically said she didn't even know what the Hayden-Cartwright Act was. It had nothing to do with how they tax Indians in Indian country.
But she doesn't set department policy. I assume the secretary does.
I assume that that's correct, that she does. But when the department is taking the position that the only reason we're imposing this tax is because Congress authorized it, and the person who's in charge of the tax doesn't even know that this is... anything about this statute, says she's never seen these reports that they're supposed to get.
Isn't that where the subjective and objective test comes in that the state was discussing?
It's an odd test to say, was the position based in truth? The department says we only did this because Congress authorized it. In fact, I think the U.S. Supreme Court got it right when it characterized these Hayden-Cartwright Act arguments that states began making in 1995. When they said, when they called it a newly discovered claim of vintage legislative authorization. It is far more likely that in 1995 or somewhere around there, the department, desperately trying to justify this tax, came up with the Hayden-Cartwright Act, not that they only began imposing this tax because Congress authorized it.
Well, short of committing a fraud on the court by the Department of Revenue, when they prevail on the initial in the trial court, isn't that... taking a position in truth?
My guess is that people take positions that are not true that end up prevailing frequently.
Okay.
I want to turn to the second part of the test, because which is whether it was a reasonable legal theory. Because even if you think that Judge Brown abused his discretion and used a subjective test on the based in truth prong, it is absolutely clear that the department's legal theory with respect to the Hayden-Cartwright Act authorizing this tax was not reasonable. When we were litigating this case initially, there were already two long lines of U.S. Supreme Court precedents, one which says states can't tax Indians in Indian country unless Congress has given unmistakably clear authorization to impose those taxes, and a long line of cases that says when you're interpreting a statute with respect to Indians, if there's any ambiguity, you have to interpret it in the Indians' favor. Yet the department took a position that a statute that doesn't mention Indians, doesn't mention Indian tribes, doesn't mention Indian reservations, explicitly authorized a tax on Indian reservations. That's simply not a reasonable position. And as we pointed out in our briefing, it doesn't matter that you convince a lower court judge or a hearing examiner that you're right. That doesn't mean that the position is objectively reasonable. It may just mean that the lower court, as this court unanimously found, got it wrong. And on this point, as I mentioned earlier in the argument in response to Justice Saber's question, the vast weight of authority, in fact, every case that has been decided about the Hayden-Cartwright Act has said it did not authorize this tax. And while it's true that the department didn't know how all of those cases were going to come out, when you're trying to decide now in 2011, was that a reasonable legal position, it does matter that there have been this, I think it's five different courts, federal and state courts, that have all lined up the same way. And in the Pierce versus Underwood case from the U.S. Supreme Court that both parties have cited in the brief, the U.S. Supreme Court specifically says that while it's not necessarily dispositive, a string of wins or a string of losses, it certainly is persuasive to a court in determining whether a position is reasonable it wasn't the Department of Revenue at issue in that case, but if the government has a string of losses making the exact same argument. This court had no trouble finding that the Hayden-Cartwright Act did not authorize that tax. It was a unanimous decision that because the statute didn't mention Indians or Indian reservations, there was an unmistakably clear intent. And you didn't have to go to the legislative history because you look only at the statute. But even if you did go to the legislative history on the Hayden-Cartwright Act, again, there was no mention of Indians or Indian reservations. So Judge Brown did not abuse his discretion by finding that the department's legal position was not reasonable. The third prong of the test is whether the facts that have been alleged and the legal theory are reasonably connected. And what Judge Brown found was that if you didn't meet part one of the test and you didn't meet part two, and part three is, parts one and two, are they reasonably connected? You can't meet part three either. So he didn't abuse his discretion with respect to the third point either, and we respectfully request that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Hogan. Mr. Gillen, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to comment briefly on counsel's suggestion that in a brief we said we had collected the tax all the way back to 1923 on Indian reservations. I don't think there is a statement like that in the record. I'm not the first lawyer, as this court knows, on this case, but I think what we said, we've always collected the tax, sort of a vague statement, but I think it goes, I think that really goes back to we always collected the tax when we could legally collect the tax back to 1936. Whether or not it was actually collected on the reservation from Indian people on the reservation, there's simply no specific statement like that at all in the record that I can find. And again, Poirier's had all this time to come up with that evidence and has not done so. What does the term a position mean in the statute? Well, I think it refers to the entire case of the litigant, either the litigant being the Department of Revenue or the taxpayer, because both the Department of Revenue and the taxpayer are subject to the statute. And that makes sense, because it certainly couldn't be that the loss of any motion, loss of any issue or any sub-issue, argument or alternative argument should determine this matter. The much more sensible way to look at it, the way lawyers look at litigation, the way judges look at litigation, is to look at whether the entire case the state was substantially justified to take its entire case. And that's also consistent with Farmer, I think. This court looked at the entire record and cited conflicting results with regard to various aspects of the litigation. In that case, the department the department's action had been dismissed back in 1985 because the department failed to prosecute. The department did lose the case. And under what I understand to be Poirier's theory, what this court and Farmer should have done is gone back to 1985, perhaps, and determined what the department in 1985 was, whether it was sincere in prosecuting its case. But Farmer didn't do that. Farmer looked at the entire case. And of course, the other way to look at Farmer, the state wins on that theory too, because the department had presented a legal question that the court had not yet answered, the department's position was substantially justified. Of course, that's what occurred here. We not only have a case of first impression, as Poirier one said, but we think it's a strong case. It didn't win, but we think it nonetheless is a strong case. What is the scope of review of the circuit court decision? Farmer and Northern States both did interpret it, like I've said. Farmer refers to an abuse of discretion standard, but the important thing about the abuse of discretion standard is within that is that legal error is subject to plenary de novo review by this court. And it seems to us that the questions here are de novo in any case. It seems to us the cases here are legal questions in any case. But we do think that that's at least worth considering that what this court has actually done is apply de novo review to the entire case. And it seems to us that that's reasonable. This is a case decided on the cold record. That's the kind of case the Supreme Court engages in de novo review on. And the Stockwell case does seem to fall right within the Stockwell case. When the question at issue requires the court to consider legal concepts in the mix of fact and law and to exercise judgment about the values that animate the legal principles, then concerns the judicial administration counsel de novo review. So it seems to us that there is a good argument that what the court has actually been doing in the Farmer case and in the Farmer case especially has applied de novo review to the entire case because that's what it did. A legal rule had been violated there. The lower court had not considered that the case was first impression. This court reversed, applied the correct rule, ended the case right there. We think that's what should happen here. To make it clear, no matter what standard review is adopted, we think that the state should be successful either on abuse of discretion or on de novo review, especially considering that even in the abuse of discretion analysis, de novo review will apply to legal questions. Poirier has argued that the state didn't contest its interpretation of the act below, but now it seems to be saying something different from its first brief to what it's saying today. It says, well, we didn't actually make the argument at exactly the right time, that the circuit court had some briefing that was sort of late in the game, and it wasn't really till late in the game that we made the arguments. But let's take that to be what was done. I'm not sure that I agree with that. But even say that was done, the circuit court invited the briefing. I've certainly invited the briefing for a reason. I've certainly invited the briefing to hear what the parties had to say. Not so a lawyer could later say, well, it was late in the game, doesn't count. But that's exactly what counsel is doing here today. In fact, we certainly disagree that we didn't raise the reasonable man argument. We repeatedly relied upon Farmer and Northern States, which set out a reasonable man standard. And when we responded to the in-truth argument made by Poirier, we went to the reasonable man argument. For example, the state says, when you look at the state's position, it was taken in truth. This is an argument. And then it referred to paragraph 11 of an objection to a combined application for costs and motion for fees. So you go back to paragraph 11, what do you find? You find seven subparts, all of them objective arguments on why the state's position was substantially justified and taken in truth. And then the state said, when the department took its position, it was based in truth and based on the Hayden-Cartwright Act, as delineated in paragraph 12. Again, goes back to this time, 17 specific arguments which were reasonable legal basis kind of arguments. The department's brief at PA 356 says, the department has argued that its position was based in truth and that it did not lack a reasonable legal basis. We made that argument. We responded to the Gorneau testimony. For example, our appendix and in our second appendix on page 14, we said that the evidence of Gorneau was irrelevant, and we continue to argue that today. We don't think that what Gorneau thought, said, appreciated, it was important. So it was the department decided what the department found and what a reasonable person would found. That's what's important. Poirier continues to rely upon the idea that the legislation here had to be unmistakably clear or unmistakably clear, and that it couldn't possibly meet that test, and therefore the state's argument wasn't substantially justified. We think that just misreads this canon of construction. When the United States Supreme Court looks at a piece of legislation to determine whether it's clear or substantially clear, it doesn't look for neon lights. That's what Poirier's saying. You don't look for neon lights. You use the same kind of means of statutory constructions you do for every other case. And that's what, in the Chickasaw case, for example, what the court looked at. Look at its own precedent, later enactments, canon of construction involving repeals by implication, motivation behind the statute, common sense meaning, all that. In the later case, in Cass County, the court said that it was unmistakably clear that alienability of land equaled taxability, even though the statute didn't explicitly say so. So merely because another interpretation was possible, and the Supreme Court actually said this in the Cass County case, merely because another interpretation was possible didn't make the interpretation not unmistakably clear. That's Cass County, page 113. Poirier argues to the contrary. Poirier says, because it's possible that the term reservation didn't include a reservation, a court can't find it unmistakably clear that the reservation includes an Indian reservation. I think that's a fair summary of their argument. But that's just not consistent at all with Cass County. Possibility doesn't do it. When the state has a strong, reasonable argument, it is unmistakably clear. That's enough. A possibility of something else, of another interpretation, does not wipe that out. Counsel has also talked about a string of victories. I simply referred to the latest a recent district court case which upheld the state's position with regard to the whether a state charter corporation can qualify as an Indian, which is cited in our brief. If there are no more questions, sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gillen. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.